This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. U.S. senators voted on Saturday in favor of allowing witnesses in the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump, extending the proceedings as lawmakers weigh whether to convict Trump of inciting the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. The 55-45 vote in favor of allowing witnesses means a decision in the trial is unlikely to come on Saturday. Prior to the vote, closing arguments from the House lawmakers serving as prosecutors and Trump's defense attorneys had been expected on Saturday after a week-long trial. A lengthier trial could stymie efforts by Democratic President Joe Biden to move past the controversy surrounding his predecessor and push forward his own legislative agenda on COVID-19 relief and economic revival. Dozens of oil and gas tankers carrying millions of dollars worth of fuel caught fire on Saturday, creating an inferno at Afghanistan's biggest trade crossing with Iran, officials said. The blaze broke out early afternoon at a port some 120 kilometers from the city of Herat, engulfing the tankers that were parked nearby after crossing the border. At least 17 people have been taken to hospital, some of them with serious burns, said the head of the local ambulance service. The governor of Western Herat province said that there aren't the facilities to contain the fire, so they have asked the government of Iran for help. He added that the cause of the fire was unknown. A strong 7.1 magnitude earthquake struck late Saturday off the eastern coast of Japan, but no tsunami warning was issued, U.S. and Japanese authorities said. The United States Geological Survey said the quake occurred at a depth of 54 kilometers in the Pacific off Fukushima. This is VOA News, and here are some of the developments around the world regarding the global coronavirus pandemic. The head of the EU's Disease Control Agency has warned that the novel coronavirus could last indefinitely, even as global infections slowed by nearly half in the last month and vaccine rollouts gathered pace in parts of the world. ECDC Chief Andrea Amon urged European countries in particular not to drop their guard against a virus that seems very well adapted to humans and might require experts to tweak vaccines over time, as is the case with the seasonal flu. Developing new COVID-19 vaccines will not end the pandemic unless all countries receive doses in a fast and fair manner, disease experts warned on Saturday. As several nations consider implementing vaccine passports when international travel resumes, the authors of a letter published in the Lancet Medical Journal said vaccine stockpiling in wealthier countries would only prolong the global health emergency. Peru, which is facing a second wave of COVID-19 infections, has registered a record number of hospitalized cases, the health ministry said. In the past 24 hours, 213 new admissions were reported, bringing the total to 14,333. The previous record of 14,181 hospitalizations was reached on August 17th. The number of infections and deaths has quadrupled from their level at the end of December. On Friday, the country's health minister resigned amid claims that former President Martin Vizcarra was inoculated before the vaccine was available to the public. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani warned of a fourth wave of the virus as cases rise in certain areas of the Middle Eastern country hardest hit by the pandemic. He said some cities in the southwestern province of Khuzestan were now red, which is the highest on Iran's color-coded risk level, after weeks of low alert levels across the country. Iran has lost close to 59,000 lives out of more than 1.5 million cases of COVID infection. Australia's second largest city of Melbourne went from welcoming thousands of fans for its Grand Slam tennis tournament to deserted city streets overnight as millions began a five-day coronavirus lockdown. For more on these and other stories making international news headlines, we invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
They wanted the president without the president. The president had to leave office. So that I said, listen, you cannot have someone who has a legitimate mandate and you're asking him to leave, and after leaving, you will have dialogue with him. What is the sense of that? That doesn't make any sense.
Haiti's ambassador to the U.S. dismisses opposition demands for the resignation of President Jovenel Moïse.
Desire for people to see the change, we will be on the correct trajectory to get the favor of the Zambian people. To be elected into office. And the promise is that if that happens, we will respect their work.
Zambia's main opposition to organize a general assembly to elect leaders of the group on Sunday.
The workers were caught by surprise. They were just called and told this is what is going to happen. Some of them are still sitting very disappointed. Just to be called to a meeting and you'll be told there is no longer a job for you. We are going to liquidate the company.
And a Namibian workers union leader expresses disappointment over government's decision to immediately cease all Air Namibia operations. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Haiti's top envoy to the United States has dismissed demands by the opposition for President Jovenel Moïse to step down. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Ambassador Bouchit Edmond says the president will serve his full term as enshrined in the Constitution, irrespective of the attempts by opposition groups to undermine the administration in Port-au-Prince. His remarks come after the opposition named Joseph Jean-Louis Ejiagh as interim president and demanded that Mr. Moïse step down. This after accusing the president of violating the Constitution, arguing that his term of office expired on February 7. The government dismisses the accusation. In part one of the interview, Ambassador Bouchit Edmond tells me that President Moïse officially came to power in 2017, which he says means his official term ends in February 2022.
There won't be any such thing because the president did know that what they're asking, it is not constitutional. Because when you said Washington, and I will tell you the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the Organization of Cacophony, all those organizations and government that have been supporting the president mandate that will end in February 2022. Because they were there, they were observers of those elections. They know when president was elected, and they know when he's sworn in office. And they know what the Constitution says about it. The president's term is 5 years. On Sunday, February 7, 2021, President Moïse turned 48 months in power. Therefore, he has 12 more months to go. And we believe that we'll continue to carry out our duty, which is trying to make it better for the people and trying to strengthen our democratic process, which is, I believe, and we believe, that's the best way to go. Not transitional government, because transition has never brought anything positive to us.
So Ambassador Edmonds, you are therefore saying that the president is not violating the Constitution as the opposition accuses him of doing or alleging him doing?
He's not violating any way the Constitution, because the Constitution says a president term in Haiti is 5 years. This is our position. Our position is the Constitution, and the Constitution says it clearly. The president is there for 5 years, and this is what he intends, or the President Moïse, he intends to do, is to continue to work for the people until the end of his term.
There were reports of an attempted coup. What is your government's position on this attempted coup?
But our position was, we considered it as a crime, even when some people were trying to break to the democratic order, the established democratic order, because those people, they are so impatient to wait for elections. And most of them, they know they've never been able to get even 1% of the electorate. And therefore, the only way for them to be in power is always transitional government. And we saw that movie before, and we saw that movie in 2003, and we know it didn't bring anything positive to us. Therefore, we just don't want to go back to that. We want to keep the democratic process on, elections, electoral process. Everyone wants to be leader of this country. They have to go through the electoral process so the people will decide who they want for their leaders, not someone or a group of people want to be imposed themselves to the people as the leaders.
Ambassador Edmond, there is concern about rising political tension in Port-au-Prince, the capital, and beyond. Some people are expressing concern that the stance taken by the opposition choosing a judge to lead a transitional government, with the president saying he is not going anywhere, supported by other international organizations. What is the best way to resolving this tension in Haiti?
Before telling you the best way, let me tell you something. I believe it's very important for your audience to understand. What would be the benefit of this, destroying our Supreme Court? Because we have now three Supreme Court judges who have been manipulated by the opposition. There are three branches of the opposition. Each branch has their own president. One of them was chosen by the group that plotted the coup, but it failed. One was installed by the opposition saying that this is their own president, interim president. And there was another one from another bunch that they said, this is not the one we want, this is the one we want. So it's really something beyond understanding what's happening with those people and the opposition parties. So even between themselves, there is no cohesion between themselves. So now we are wondering what would happen to this country, to leave that country in the hands of those people who can't even organize themselves to give an alternative. So therefore, we understand that President Moïse, the only way out he wants, he's been calling for national dialogue, but unfortunately those people, they don't want to join the dialogue table. They want to overthrow him and be to take power through violence. This is what they want to do. And I believe the international community must not support that. And we know most of our international partners, they do not support that. Elections has to be the way to go.
Some people suggest that if the dialogue he's proposing is genuine, then the dialogue should happen without preconditions. Do you think President Moïse or your government would engage the opposition in a dialogue without any preconditions, as a means of resolving any political tension or stalemate?
Listen, this is what the president has been doing. He's been calling for dialogue. And I remember the last time he tried, it was in September last year. And he said that he doesn't want to have any, he has to be without preconditions dialogue. And he's willing to do so. But for them, when the president said that, for them, they wanted the president without the president. The president had to leave office to that. I said, listen, you cannot have someone who has a legitimate mandate and you're asking him to leave, and after leaving, you will have dialogue with him. What is the sense of that? That doesn't make any sense.
Ambassador Bushid Edmond is Haiti's top envoy to the U.S. He spoke with me from the capital, Washington, D.C. Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, or UPND, plans to organize a general assembly to elect leaders of the group on Sunday. Representatives say all positions are open for candidates who meet the party's requirements to contest. The party last held its leadership election in 2012, prompting accusations of hypocrisy and a lack of internal party democracy. Critics also say the delay violates the country's constitution. They accuse Hakainde Hichilema, presidential candidate of the party since 2012, of preventing any internal challenge, an accusation he denies. To learn more about efforts to organize Sunday elections for the opposition party, I reach Gary Nkombo, the UPND's elections chairman.
More than ready. We're just tying up all the loose ends right now. And I can confirm that on Friday, we're going to be doing our test run in terms of the virtual meeting so that nothing goes wrong in our test center.
Which positions are currently available for contestants to compete? And have these contestants already made themselves available to compete for these positions?
Our constitution is very clear. I hope you have a copy of it. Under Article 52, members are contesting in a pool, and we're looking to get 70
people who will be elected into the management position. So many people have been confused that we are trying to change our constitution. It's not to be like that. We are all vying to be in the national management committee, and then once the top 70 are elected, then the president is going to assign people into a particular portfolio.
Supporters of the Patriotic Front said some supporters of the UPND have accused the PF of lacking internal democracy and the president being dictatorial and all that. Yet the party, the UPND, last held its general election in 2012 to select its leaders. So your party, they argue, lacks internal democracy and does not have the moral high ground to accuse the Patriotic Front of lacking party internal democracy, or the president for that matter, having dictatorial tendencies. Do you think their criticisms are fair?
Well, I can only respond for the things that I say and not for the things that you heard somebody say. And so if you say some of our members are accusing the PM of not being democratic, I could not comment on it. I'm not competent enough to comment about the internal democracy of PF. But people are there and their eyes are open for them to see how they are running their affairs.
Where does the party go from here after Sunday's election?
After Sunday's election, when we get a new management team, our sole responsibility is to now start preparing for the general election that's coming up on the 12th of August, 2021.
Looking at the political landscape in Zambia, people are saying that the UPND might need to enter into an alliance with some other opposition political parties in order to have a chance to defeat incumbent President Edgar Lungu. Do you think the assessment is correct or accurate?
Well, the more the opposition cooperates, the more the chances of winning. I want you to remember that even when we're not in an alliance with anybody in 2016, we were able to get up to the 48% mark after an election being lost. And so we are confident that we belong to the group of the masses, but it goes without saying that, you know, alliances are the way to go. If you want to read of how they want to maybe describe Kiev, malignant. If you want to avoid, to get rid of the malignant, you have to congregate as a group and together amputate that malignant. And in this case, fear is the malignant. And so there's no reason for anyone to run an ego in their head, because it is very clear that Mr. Hichilo had a test of the presidency because of that 1% difference that was recorded in 2016. In as far as we are concerned, the 1% difference was manipulated. Now we still contend that had their petition not been thrown out, Hichilo would be the president of this country.
What do you think are the prospects of your party in winning the presidential election this August?
Okay, well, look, firstly, we are having a challenge of COVID-19, and because the constitutional requirement that we go to the polls, we are going to have 3,000 people, delegates plus or minus, plus an extra maybe, 200 invited guests or observers to this big function. This is one of the biggest that Zambia has recorded in the last 5 years of the congregation. And so after we are all settled and finished with this party election, it's called reprofiling ourselves, it's called renewing the energy. We are quite hopeful that based on the sense of fear and also based on the desire for people to see the change, we will be on the correct trajectory to get the favor of the Zambian people to be elected into office. And the promise is that if that happens, we will respect their will.
Gary Nkombo is election chairman of the Zambian Opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers says the government's decision to immediately cease all Air Namibia operations is disappointing. Job Munyeru says his workers' group did not receive any warnings from the administration despite engaging government officials over Air Namibia issues for the last few years. This after the government announced Air Namibia was suspending all operations beginning Thursday. It led to the cancellation of flights as well as the grounding of aircraft. The National Union of Namibian Workers says about 600 employees and other businesses associated to the national carrier lost their jobs with the announcement. Analysts say the global coronavirus pandemic appeared to have worsened the financial challenges facing the national air carrier. To learn more about concerns of the former Air Namibia workers following the announcement to stop all operations, I read Job Munyeru, Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers.
It's a very disappointing announcement because one needs to say we need to consult first before someone takes such a drastic and very damaging decision. The workers and the Namibian people are all disappointed to lose their national pride. That has an employment of close to 600 workers, and in the same time that has close to 4,500 beneficiaries in terms of other companies that takes also employment through the services of Namibia. That's quite a very disappointing decision. And we were not expecting it to happen because we were not even consulted. We have just had the decisions through the media.
Job, as a representative of the workers, have you or your group made any attempt at seeking an explanation as to this decision taking that you said took you by surprise?
Not per se to say it took us by surprise, because two or three years ago, up to last year, we have been in negotiation. And then we have set up a committee, of course, on Air Namibia to consult each other in terms of how we can rescue the situation and also rescue the employment. But all of a sudden, the committee that we have established ourselves together with government has never materialized and has never been consulting each other. So the only consultation or the only surprise is to hear that the government has taken a decision to liquidate. And even in the liquidation, we don't know how the workers and all those that are going to benefit. Not for a worker to lose job, it's not just a job that is lost. The value of the person and the integrity of the person is touched. It is very suppressive if you to see you lose your medical aid, you lose your car, possibly if you have a car through the bank loan, you lose your house, you lose all properties that you have been acquired that was guaranteed through a salary of every month. So the whole, you lose even the bread on your table. So it depends if one person caters care for more than five people and you have 600 people, then multiply 500 times five. It gives you a very big number of people that are dependent on employment of such a big number of people.
What is your group going to do on behalf of the workers in terms of engaging government, perhaps for severance, for anything to cushion the effect of them losing their jobs?
The unprocedural decision of just dumping workers are not going to be left that way. We are going to challenge it through any means. We are not going to sit and seeing our brothers and sisters suffering under a decision that is completely very inhuman. So that's a fact that it's not going to be a smooth decision the way people think it should be. I think that's a high time for government to be instructed to take decisions such as firing such people that are giving ill-advised decisions in order for that to be taken place.
What is the recourse for these employees who are losing their jobs?
Possibly there's nothing. These workers were caught by surprise. They were just called and told this is what is going to happen. Some of them are still sitting very disappointed. Just to be called to a meeting and you'll be told there's no longer job for you. We are going to liquidate the company.
Job Munyeru is the Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. Botswana says it will not abolish the death penalty despite global criticism from the United Nations and others. This after the execution of two death row inmates this week. For VOA, Nkodi Sindube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
The United Nations led calls for Botswana to abolish the death penalty. The UN office in Botswana asked the government to place a moratorium on all executions with a view to its abolition. The delegation of the European Union to Botswana also condemned the practice, describing it as cruel and inhuman. The EU delegation called for an immediate referendum in Botswana to determine the future of capital punishment. The High Commissioners of Australia, Canada, New Zealand and the United Kingdom issued a joint statement all condemning the practice. Despite the outcry, Attorney General Abraham Kitsabe said the death penalty remains part of the country's laws.
I have always taken the position that Botswana is a unique country and that the country should retain its unique originality. On the death penalty, the platform on which we stand is that it is the law. It is in the law. It is part of our law. And it should therefore be applied in appropriate cases.
He said murderers will continue to face the hangman.
Let it be true that murderers should, without exception, face the true and accurate consequences of their actions or inactions. In Botswana, we have agreed as a nation that the punishment for unlawfully taking away another person's life is death.
Botswana has executed 54 death row inmates since the Southern African country's independence in 1966. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
A survey by the Kenya Association of Manufacturers shows that women are dominating the East African country's top mechanized jobs, although men still own most businesses and have better paying jobs. For VOA, Victoria Amunga reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, on one businesswoman who started her own natural foods packaging company.
Esther Kojuang's natural foods packaging firm has grown by leaps and bounds since she started it 5 years ago. She and other women are leaders in Kenyan manufacturing, but Kojuang says it still can be difficult to deal with the men in the industry.
For example, you want to supply your honey to a big company, and the procurement manager might be a man who might want more from you than you're willing to give. You just want to do clean business.
Despite Kenyan men having most and better paid manufacturing jobs, Kenyan women are dominating the sector's top careers. A September Kenya Association of Manufacturers survey says even male owners seem to prefer having women run their factories, with 89% of their senior managers being women. Phyllis Wakiaga is the association's chief executive officer.
What this demonstrates is that when you have also boards or leaders who support the growth of women within the manufacturing sector, you tend to see policies put in place that mainstream gender into the boardroom. And what this leads to is that more women are able to rise to top leadership positions.
But women owners like Kojuang are still a minority, with men owning 73% of Kenya's factories. Cleopatra Mugenyi, director of the African Regional Office at the International Center for Research on Women, explains why women are taking up manufacturing.
Why they're going into it? Because they're seeing it's a lucrative sector. It's a sector that has opportunities. But we have to understand that even though we're having more women go into manufacturing, right, most of their jobs and most of their businesses are actually informal.
Mugenyi says those companies that do have more women attract and retain talent and are better able to gauge consumer interest and demand. To help level the playing field, Kenyan authorities say they're helping to fund women manufacturers. Lawrence Karanja is the Ministry of Industrialization Chief Administration Secretary.
We have various programs and projects to support women in manufacturing. First, you know, we have the Women Enterprise Fund, which is available. We are giving loans. We have partnered with our other institution, for instance, Micro and Small Enterprise Authority. We are giving funds to women.
That gives Kenya's women manufacturing leaders more hope for a just future in the industry. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Rockefeller Foundation has announced a new grant of $12 million to the Africa Public Health Foundation. The grant is to help expand testing and strengthen contact tracing for COVID-19 in Africa through the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Officials say the grant also seeks to support vaccination efforts at the community level when vaccines are available on the continent beginning in the second quarter of 2021. The funding will support a broader effort to accelerate equitable access to testing technologies, increase testing of asymptomatic persons, and reduce community transmission of COVID-19 in sub-Saharan Africa. To learn more about the anticipated impact the grant will have in the fight to contain the coronavirus in Africa, I reach the CDC Director of Africa, Dr. John Nkengasong.
It is very significant. I think we need all hands on deck to move the fight against COVID-19 forward in Africa and, of course, the world. We are at a crossroads on the continent where we have to do a couple of things and do them quickly. One is really to continue to work with our member states to make sure that vaccines are rolled out. They are, first of all, acquired and then roll out appropriately. And the whole strategy to roll out vaccines will require that we continue to mobilize resources from both the continent, within the continent, and outside of the continent. So from that perspective, we truly value that contribution that was announced today.
You talked about being at a crossroad in the fight against the disease. What is the current status of the effort by the African Union and by extension, your organization, in fighting or combating to limit the spread of the disease on the continent?
So let's start with where we are with the pandemic. I mean, as we speak today, over 3.6 million people have been infected on the continent on a cumulative basis. And of that, about close to 95,000 people have died. And if you look at the curve, we are really, we have experienced the second wave, and we are at a point where countries collectively are reporting a downward trend in the rate of daily cases there. I think mainly driven by what we are seeing in South Africa. So you see that our curve has gone up once and come down, and then it's gone up the second time and it's coming down again. So the reason I start with that is that it speaks to the extraordinary efforts, the sacrifices and the devotion that the continental leadership has applied themselves in fighting this pandemic. I mean, we have bent the curve twice, not because of vaccines, but because the countries really took that seriously, and they are doing all what it takes to bring this pandemic under control while waiting for vaccines. So I think on that, I really applaud the efforts of the continental leadership, both at the African Union level, led by Chairperson Moussa Faki, and the outgoing President of the African Union, His Excellency Cyril Ramaphosa. I'm very encouraged by that approach, and I hope that the whole concept of coordination, cooperation, collaboration, and communication will continue to sustain the drive to get this pandemic out of our way.
Talking about this grant, how would this support the effort to accelerate equitable access to testing technologies, increasing testing of asymptomatic persons, and reducing community transmissions of the disease in the sub-region?
So, I mean, if you recall, we launched what we call the Partnership to Accelerate COVID Testing, in abbreviation PAC, last year, which is really centered around scaling up testing. We have since then done remarkably well on the continent to really move testing from where we were. When we launched the PAC initiative, the continent had recorded, was conducting about 300,000 tests. And today, the continent has conducted about 31 to 32 million tests, which is remarkable progress. We have now shifted our efforts. In addition to the standard molecular tests, we are supporting countries with an extensive scale-up of the antigen test, which is a simpler test, easy to use, easy to roll out. And of course, it will perform similarly to the molecular assays. So this 4 million will go a long way to support such efforts so that we can scale up testing and understand where and how the virus is spreading. And of course, design strategies. We are in the pit at this moment trying to shift our strategy. And rather than focus on the testing, the trace and the treatment, we'll be looking at more on monitoring, prevention and treatment, given where we are with this pandemic. So that the 4 million goes a long way to support the shift in strategy that we will be announcing and rolling out across the continent.
Well, talking about the shift in strategy, various reports have come up with variants of the disease. How do you plan in tackling this across the continent?
No, that's a very good question. If you look at our first strategy, which was essentially centered around test, trace, and treat, our new strategy will focus on monitoring. And under monitoring, you have a lot to be done there. We'll be looking at sero surveys. I mean, asking a basic question of how many people have been exposed to the virus and have actually recovered from the virus. I think that is very important. It will teach us, it will give us the essential information on the extent of spread of the virus that has actually not been captured by standard testing. So that is one. The second thing that the shifted strategy will do is that we'll increase the ability to do genomic sequencing, that is to understand the genetic, how diverse the virus is, the whole concept of the mutants there. So Africa CDC has set up what we call the Pathogen Genomic Institute, which is a network of centers of excellence across the continent that will continue to generate such data. And our target is to be able to sequence and generate about 50,000 genomic sequences from now to the next 6 months or so, so that we can really understand the extent of spread of these new variants and how they are changing over time. So I think that is part of the new strategy that we will be announcing very shortly.
Dr. John Nkengasong is the CDC Director of Africa. He spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Nimechoka kunywa kwinini. Nice ukicha, nusu taira uchizi, naona kinyama songo. Niyamaga, rambi kaipiga mbizi, ikanipasua ubongo, ubongo. Ange nambia basi, tunge achana kizungu. Ngepana fasi, kuliko kutupanga mafungu. Nisinga kasi, japo ningumu kachungu. Chanya na hasi, anapangaka Mungu. Kibatari kalibisha tambi, penzi limelipuka. Yanachiti haugopi dhambi, anaruka ruka. Moyo kaupiga bambi, umeshateuka. Popote anaweka kambi, kutwa nachepuka. Yani
wale wale
wanokujaga kwa tafadhali na kupenda,
wale wale
wakimaliza shida zao anakwenda.
Wale wale
etio nilipotoka nilitenda,
wale wale
kumbe ni wao. Changing
Mami amenipa mazongi na jikaza kisamuni. Sawa mimi ni mnyonge, damu yangu ya kunguni. Mifungu la tatu kibon, mwenzangu la kela lumi. Angenambia basi, tungeachana kisungu. Ngefanya fast, kuliko kutupana mafungu. Tari kazidisha tambi, penzi limelipuka. Yanachiti haugopi dhambi, anaruka ruka. Moyo kaupiga bambi, umeshateuka. Popote anaweka kambi, kutu anachepuka. Yani
wale wale
wanofutia kapata patani na kupenda.
Wale wale
wakimaliza shida zao anakwenda. Nilipotoka nini tena?
Wale wale
kumbe ni waongo. Mwacha fanya nachoka.
Anikomoi wala nikomoi,
sishtuki hata.
Anikomoi wala nikomoi,
usina mashaka.
Anikomoi wala nikomoi,
uwe anatapatapa.
Anikomoi wala nikomoi.
Music from thebase.ng.
pleasure, pleasure. Boy, yeah, say the fini boy, of course. If I don't say that, I can't say what I can't touch. If people look when I'm back, I'm sick of popcorn. In MS, I'm working on a puno, even last spawn. Eh, the way you shaking is your bum bum. Now, the very obvious, so that I want some. I shut up, I'm a cook of chata. From the forget him, I can't get it in a data. Ungano, what do you mean, baby? 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 Ungano, what do you mean, baby?
I'm
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if your mouth turns into a knife, it will cut off your lips. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.